Succession number 27083, Reel 18.
Sir Henry, I think you've just been appointed a junior instructor at Weyland.
That's correct. And to my surprise and considerable mortification, I was told that I was required to report for duty on New Year's Day, 1948. It was entirely unnecessary. It was quite absurd. It was just a slip in the drill, I think. And when I got there, of course, there was nobody else around. And everybody seemed to be surprised. And what was I doing back so soon from Christmas leave? Which at the end of a year's, in fact, 15 months, fairly strenuous course, was a bit mean. But there it was. Well, then the training commander came back from leave in due course. I knew that I was going to be teaching sub-lieutenants, and I knew that I was going to be parade training officer.
Can I just interrupt? How many years so far had you now been a lieutenant? You had to do your 8, you told me, but so you'd be a lieutenant how long?
I suppose I had about 3 years in as a lieutenant.
Moderately juniorish still?
Yes. Yes, I was one of the junior ones in the course. Well, then I went and sort of reported to the training commander, who was a man called James Farnell, who was he was a charming chap. We became great friends, despite our difference in rank. But I have to say that his knowledge of gunnery could have been written on the back of a single postage stamp with a felt pen. However, he said he was a great showman, and he was full of blah. When I reported to him at the outset, I well remember his reaction, and he glared at me, and he had a rather sort of fearsome appearance, but we got to know each other, and that didn't bamboozle me at all. And he said, "From now on, your every action should be tempered by injustice." And that was that. He made it very clear that as parade training officer, I was responsible for the standard of smartness throughout the island, and so on, which I really knew already. And I'll say no more about that. It was a very high standard, too, very high. It was an enormous pleasure, as I quickly found, to be teaching the sub-lieutenants. They were all different. Each course was different. Not to say that one was better or another worse or anything of that sort, but they were just different. And within a matter of the first week out of, I think it was a 6 week or 8 week course that they did. And then by the end of the first week, they were your friends for life. There was the odd exception who possibly would never have been your best friend, but they were very much the odd exceptions. On the parade, I had an excellent staff. I had a splendid gunner called Mr. Manners, little man, tough as a nut, very smart, absolutely what was required. And two in particular, absolutely exceptional chief gunner instructors. One was called Tex Burrell, and we'll come back to him a bit later. And the other was a man called Brooks. Very, very fine, salt of the earth, very senior chief petty officers. And we got on very well. And there were a lot of other lesser fry on the parade staff, just gunner instructors at petty officer level. Well, then the day came. I ran through two or three subgroups. And got really a very satisfactory result from them in terms of first-class certificates. This was their fault rather than mine, but they had to have a bit of mine, because otherwise they wouldn't have learnt it, and so on. And then one day I was sent for by, I think it was by the first lieutenant, that's right, who was a man called Weston, terribly nice man, a rather improbable gunnery officer in that he was quite gentle and so on, and didn't appear to have any bite at all, but very nice. And he it was that allocated subgroups to the junior staff instructors. And he said, your next group, Egyptian sub-lieutenants. And my heart sank. And I started to remonstrate and say, I wasn't sure, because I'd done my time in Alexandria and blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't sure that I was terribly happy with Egyptians. And if I wasn't very happy, they probably wouldn't be very happy with me, and so on. And after a bit, I got under his skin, I suppose, and he said, you very well take the Egyptian sub-lieutenants and get on with it. And that was that. Very sensibly. What I hadn't realized was he tried it out on two others, and they both said the same thing. So I was saddled with the Egyptian sub-lieutenants. And they, I think, I could go on and on about them. But they joined on, I suppose, on a Saturday night. And I deliberately cancelled my own weekend leave, so I'd be around, as they were foreigners, I'd be around to help them any way I could as they joined. And the first thing I saw of them was at breakfast on Sunday. And I walked into breakfast in plain clothes, as was customary then, because it was a weekend. And there, at intervals around the table in the mess, in the wardroom, were a few perfectly normal configuration in terms of height and girth and so forth. Some really quite massive and bulky and obese, all pretty dusky, all needing haircuts, and most of them with quite vigorous moustaches. And they were all sort of, they were gobbling their breakfast up and so on. And it was a lovely summer's day, and they all went out on the lawn in front of the mess afterwards. And I went out and joined them there. And I got there, they were sort of split up, and there were 13 or so of them altogether. And they were in groups of three or four. And the first group I came to, I said, good morning. And they gave me a sort of cold non-response. And I would say, you've rather wetly, you found your way here, all right? And they grunted yes. And I said, I hope you've got everything you need. And they grunted yes. And they were generally a pretty surly lot, I thought. And so my final not so much question, the statement was, I just wanted to come and meet you, because I shall be your officer instructor and looking after you for the next, whatever it was, 7 weeks. And instantly, they all flashed out their cigarette cases and offered me a cigarette, and by the way, yes, sir, no, sir, 3 bags, full, sir, and that sort of thing. And that was the start of things. Well, now I, perhaps to my shame, but rather unkindly, had arranged that their program was as difficult for them as it could be. And so instead of going to a lecture and then going on to another lecture And then eventually when they had to go down on the parade, go down onto the parade ground, and then for the next period they would go across to the almost adjacent West Battery, which was a normal way of doing things. I'd arranged that if they had a period of parade training, they would do that. And then they had to double all the way up to the lecture room. And then they had to double all the way down to the gun battery and so forth. So they spent a lot of time doubling around and so on. Unkind, but I wasn't very well disposed towards Egyptian sub-lieutenants. Can we draw stumps, Isaac?
Of course.
Well, I could go on and on about the Egyptian subs. They were, I suppose.
But you weren't well disposed, really.
Not really, but I came to terms. They didn't impress me much. I may say they were enormously older than I was, and I was their instructor. The eldest was 32, and he looked it. But then they lived that way, I think. A couple of them had allowances from their parents, and I can't remember what the figure was, but it was something like £500 a month, which was way beyond anything that I had, let alone any other British sub-lieutenants. All went fairly well. They weren't a very intelligent lot. They didn't hoist what I had to offer them in with anything like the rapidity that the British subs did. Plus the Commonwealth contemporaries and so forth. And then one day I was summoned by the training commander, who asked me how it was with the Egyptian sub-lieutenants. And thinking to get a bit of my own back, I said, well, sir, it's as good as you might have expected, considering that they are Egyptian sub-lieutenants, which I had previously represented. Oh, he said, why do you ask, sir? Well, he said, I've noticed that for the last 3 days, during the lunch hour, what I took to be the senior boy was in the telephone cabinet in the front hall, and he was there for ages. And so yesterday, I hovered around a bit to see if I could pick up who he was talking to. And he was talking to their embassy in London. Are you sure that you're being all right with these chaps? And I said, yes, sir, they're getting the proper treatment. And that was that. We left. And the next thing that happened was that I was again sent for, this time by the first lieutenant, and told that his opposite number in Portsmouth Barracks had got on to him to say that the Egyptian sub-lieutenants, then reputedly at Whale Island, and they were the subject of a complaint by a number of sailors in the barracks that the Egyptian subs were stealing the sailors' girlfriends. Oh, I said, I shouldn't be at all surprised. It's a no-holds-barred situation with them. And they got oodles of money, and it's running out of their ears and so forth. That was that. Right at the end of their course, during the last 10 days or so, before their final exams, I'd realized by then that they'd sort of formed cliques, as it were, two or three in each. All a bit different. Each clique didn't appear to get on terribly closely with the next clique or cliques. And each clique took it in turns to take me out to what they had considered to be the finest place in Portsmouth for dinner, namely the Queen's. Actually, it was not the finest place by any means in terms of food, but so, never mind. To give me a slap-up dinner. And I thought, oh, how charming when the first one came up. What a nice thing to do. Little did I know. We had a perfectly good dinner, and of course I wasn't talking shop or anything. Or we just chatted away. And several of them had their wives over. And they were very handsome girls. Very handsome. Unlike these ghastly, drooping moustache warriors, and so on. And then when it got to about the food or the savoury stage, and it was a full-blown dinner, the senior member of that clique would say, "Now, sir, what are we going to be asked in our exams?" And I said, "I don't know." I was quite honest about it. I said, "I don't set your exams." I said, "I've taken a number of subcourses before yours. I have a very shrewd idea the sort of question that you're going to be asked in your exams. And I'm at pains to ensure that you have addressed the answers to those sorts of questions as part of your instruction. But I don't know what in the event you will actually be asked, and I never shall until the day." I don't think they believed a word of it, but that was that. Well, there were three cliques, and I was forewarned by this for the second and the third, and so on. And really, that was the end. They scrambled through. They none of them did terribly well. We went on to other things. Well, then the next event that occurred to me was that the Commander-in-Chief Portsmouth by then was Bruce Fraser. He had come away from the home fleet at CNC, gone out to the Far East as the BPF CNC, had not taken over as First Sea Lord, because Andrew Cunning did, and Bruce had made the famous remark that whereas he had obtained the respect from the whole of his fleet, Andrew Cunning had obtained the respect of the entire Navy, and he turned down being First Sea Lord. But he was First Sea Lord later, of course, and a good one too. Anyway, he was CNC Portsmouth. And there were two visiting American destroyers, commanded by commanders. And Bruce Fraser got hold of me, I think really out of kindness, and he was an extremely kind man, and because I'd been his flag lieutenant temporarily for a week up in Scarpa in his days of CNC fleet, and so on. And I was included in a lunch party wrapped around these two visiting destroyers commanding officers. And I sat more or less opposite the CNC, who had on either side the two American commanding officers. And therefore I wasn't really involved in the conversation the other side of the table. But I overheard much of it, certainly the gist of it. And quite early on, the CNC became involved in a heated discussion with one of the American CEOs over the relative merits of the standard American destroyer's gun, which is a 5-inch, and the standard British destroyer's gun, which was a 4.5-inch. And this went on and on. And I was conscious of this in the background and heard it. And they actually got down to details like the weight of the projectile. The throw weight was the OK phrase. And the American, of course, knew precisely what the weight of a 5-inch shell was. And Bruce Fraser did not know the weight of a 4 or 5 inch British shell. And turned to me across the table and said, "Oh, here's someone he will know. He's just qualified as a gunnery officer. He knows everything there is to know about gunnery. Come on." And I hadn't the remotest idea. But they'd been bandying about a certain figure. And I tried to get away with it, and I pretended to sort of think, and said, "Yes, sir, it is." But I hadn't a clue. And it didn't fool him for a second. And he said, "You're guessing." He said, turned to the American and said, "Here you are, you know, he's just qualified as a gunnery officer, and he doesn't know the weight of the standard shell of the standard British destroyer's gun." Ha, 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 ha. And Rockwood laughed, and I felt very small. That was it. When lunch was over and the Americans went their way, and Bruce Fraser, I can't remember why, but he lived somewhere over the other side in Gosport at the time. Something was going on in Everly House, I think. And he gave me a lift back to Whaley, at least as far as the end of Stanley Road, which was the end of the approaches, where he tipped me out in his car, driven by a Royal Marines driver and so forth. And as I got out, he said, with mock severity, "Now you ought to go straight to your captain and report to him, from me, that you didn't know sound where the sound stores gone, blah, 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 blah." And feeling slightly uncomfortable, off I went. Well, of course, I didn't report to my captain. But that night, the captain was a man called Pat McLaughlin. And that night, as was his custom, he came into the wardroom, anteroom, for a glass of sherry before dinner, that sort of thing. And I thought this was a good moment to put it to him. And of course, he didn't know the answer either. And shortly afterwards, we were joined by a man called Harold Dan Reuter, who was one of the long course instructors of the next long course. And he was a great big chap, jolly, full of ball. His younger brother had been in my long course, in fact, and ultimately became my best man when I got married. And he didn't know the answer. And he tried to blast me. He said, I know 5.25 and I know 6 inch. Well, I do those two. But nobody knew a 4.5. So it was left in the air. And the next thing that happened was that Michael Lefanu, who eventually became First Sea Lord and would have gone on as CDS, but developed leukemia, and that was the end of him. And he was the, as a commander, he was in charge of the experimental department at Whale Island. And he had been the assistant fleet gunnery officer as a young lieutenant commander when Bruce Fraser had been the commander-in-chief, Home Fleet. And word got to him. And so a few months later, when Bruce Fraser was due to have, I think it was a birthday, and I don't know which one, but he was getting on a bit then. And because they had the facilities and so forth, Michael Lefanu had produced a little model. I'll show you it in a moment, I've got it still. A little model of a 4.5 shell. And it has a detachable bit on the end, which is described on the piece as the Fraser attachment. And he had been at pains to get on to the ammunition depot to find out the precise weight in terms of pounds and down to grams and even grains, I think. We'll see it in a moment. And that was that one. Then the next incident that came my way, bearing in mind I was parade training officer, was a formal burial at sea. And I'd already done a couple on land, and they weren't much fun, but so. And we had a paymaster captain, a Captain S, called Valentine Duke. Funny little man, knee-high to a grasshopper. I think he was a bachelor. He drank pretty heavily. He lived pretty hard. He loved sailing service boats. And he did everything absolutely flat out. And he came into the mess one night at a guest night dinner, and even as grace was about to be said, he slipped under the table, and he had a stroke, which I think surprised nobody, but there it was. And off he went to Hasler, and they pulled him together, but told him to lay off, or else. And, of course, he wasn't ever inclined. And I suppose it would have been in November, December even. And by this time, he'd got onto the bottle again a bit. And he had another stroke, and that was it. And I was summoned and told that I was to be in charge of this funeral, which was to take place in order to put Whale Island back on the map. Now, there was intense rivalry between Excellent and Vernon, the torpedo school. Intense. There'd always been a bit of rivalry, but this was really intense. And, to be frank, Vernon was coming up the strait, had almost come up the strait, and was in risk of being smarter overall than Whale Island, and this wouldn't do at all. And this funeral was going to put Whale Island back on the map, and I was told to make it so. And there was to be a service on the quarter deck at Whale Island, quite briefly, simply in order to have a sort of funeral march down to the pierhead to embark in the gunnery firing ship, the Modeste. Quite unnecessary. I mean, you've gone straight on board Modeste, but there it was. And it was a foul day in the middle of winter, and it was blowing half a gale at least. And we got on board Modeste, and I was in charge at that stage, which was the sort of key position. I was in charge of the firing party, the funeral firing party. And we clambered on board, and we fell in on the fantail. They didn't have a quarter deck, really. The ship wasn't big enough. And there, on a little slide, a platform, off the starboard quarter, was the coffin. Port quarter, yeah, and whichever it was, draped in a Union flag, and there were the funeral firing party, and as we, with myself standing in front of them, were all wearing great coats and so forth, bitterly cold, blowing hard, and occasional showers of sleet and so forth. And as we cleared the harbour, the wind picked up even more, of course, and the ship began to lift a bit with the sea. And I got that what the navigation manual very aptly describes for the approach of a typhoon: an indefinable feeling that all is not well. And I couldn't think what it was. And then I saw that the Union flag covering the coffin was flapping up, flapping down in the wind, flapping up, flapping down. And I had a sort of acute feeling that I ought to go and have a look at the coffin. I didn't know what I was looking for. And I did. And I had a look. And I quickly saw that, so far as I could see, there were no holes in the bottom of the coffin
to let the water in.
To let the water in.
So it would
float. So it would float. I fortunately I discovered this just as we were clearing Portsmouth Harbour. And so I'd sent somebody along to the tippy shop. And we actually finally cleared harbour with the funeral firing party, including Leach, you know, trying to keep their balance and so forth, resting in their arms reversed and so on. And Chippy with a brazen bit in the underside of the coffin. But it was a near squeak because, even from what the little I've said, you'll realise that sailors can be quite superstitious. And if the coffin had floated away, there would have been nothing short of a disaster. So that was that one. Well.
And you'd have had to have chased it all over the harbour because it would have taken some time.
I suppose they'd have sunk it with gunfire. So it would have been a great to-do, and undoubtedly the media would have got hold of it. I had, overall, a very happy 18 months on the junior staff at Whaley. I had a very good record of groups with...